I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Current Geek, the talk show about items of interest to geeks of the world and you. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt.
Well, hello, Scott Johnson. I am, in fact, Tom Merritt. Thank you for noticing.
Got Gavel McLeod with him today.
Woo! Sure do.
Always there.
Everything is ready for the perfect podcast.
Wow. Has anyone ever made one yet, or is tonight the one?
This is it. This is the first time. Ladies and gentlemen, you are witnesses to history.
Oh, my Lord. All right. I'm ill-prepared for this enormous event that we're about to have.
Mm-hmm.
But
the signing of the armistice of St. Petersburg,
uh-huh,
or the sack of Rome.
Uh-huh.
This is amongst the great historical events of our people's history.
Well, then we better do this first.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
What momentous, one-of-a-kind things happened?
Before the last couple of weeks, did you know what Star Wars Scene 38 was? If I said Scene 38 of Star Wars, would you have known what I was talking about? Because I wouldn't have.
I know. I have not. I did not know any of this before you put it in our stuff. So,
well, Scene 38 is the scene where Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader have a lightsaber duel in Star Wars, or as it has come to be known in later years, Star Wars: A New Hope. However, the folks over at Fix It in Post, spelled FX, get it? Like FX? Mm-hmm. FXITIN Post, have edited the classic lightsaber duel to be more dynamic, one might say, more in line with the lightsaber duels of the later movies, including Jedi, the prequels, even Force Awakens, etc. Christopher Clements, the visual effects artist behind Fix It in Post, so when I say the people, I guess I mean Christopher Clements, worked as a visual effects supervisor on multiple indie films and television shows, and has done this to kind of show off his chops, but also to entertain us with an updated version of the Obi-Wan Kenobi Darth Vader lightsaber battle.
Yeah, it's actually really, really cool. Part of me is like, you know what, that first one's fine, don't mess with it too much. We didn't know what we were doing yet. It was much more of a gentleman's sword duel back then.
Yeah, and George Lucas, I've read a few things where George Lucas was very adamant at the time that this should be a two-handed lightsaber duel, right? That these lightsabers were akin to the heavier swords and required them to do two-handed battle, which is slower. Mm-hmm. It's less dynamic than if you can, you know, do a lighter saber battle.
Right. And then the other part of me says consistency with the other parts of Star Wars is kind of cool, and this seems consistent. Obviously, this isn't official, but this is more consistent with what came later. So part of me is like, yeah, man, that's how it should have been. These guys should have been jumping all over the place. Look at Obi-Wan in previous incarnations, and he wasn't, you know, all that young. And, you know, Vader's been a mess for a long time. He should have been able to move a little bit more. But, you know, it's 1977. And these guys, they don't know. They're just
It was the first lightsaber battle ever, right?
Right.
And it's an insight into George Lucas that he was like, no, we must hew to the traditional Bushido way of battle, two-handed swords and everything. And people are like, sure, I guess. I don't know. No one's ever had a lightsaber battle before. Let's try it. And then Lucas later goes, you know, maybe we could let him just use one hand because that's a lot more exciting.
Yeah. Plus the things only weigh. I mean, the light weighs nothing. And the actual things are like a heavy flashlight. So,
Right. Sure,
you could, if you think about the actual physics of that, when I was a kid, the way it was portrayed here with Vader and Obi-Wan, it felt like these were, like you said, heavy, two-handed
blades. You could retcon it and say that the resistance of the photons in the saber causes it to be hard to move around because, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But fact of the matter is, Lucas just realized, like, yeah, it's too slow.
Yeah.
Let's let him go one-handed.
This is also the way I prefer it. I prefer the canonical stuff to just stay put, including things, you know, Lucas unnecessarily does to it. Just leave it and let it be what it is. And then let fans and artists and others come up with cool stuff later to say, what if this fight seems more dynamic? And that's how it should be. That's how this stuff's supposed to
know.
Go.
I mean, first of all, if George Lucas wants to do something cool, he should be allowed to. He shouldn't be disallowed from it. If because he's George Lucas, for goodness sake, he invented the whole thing.
Yeah.
But he also shouldn't force us to only see the cool things that he has decided. So I'm kind of somewhere in the middle on this. Like, I love this. In fact, I'd love to see a version of New Hope that included this and maybe some other stuff from Fix It in Post. That could be fun. But don't take away my other versions if I would rather see those. Give me all the available versions.
Yeah.
All of that said, if you really think about this, this is basically taking a New Hope and making this lightsaber battle more consistent with the prequels.
Yes. Well, it is.
And so prequel haters who love this are going to have a little, have to have a little conversation with themselves about that.
Well, yeah, I suppose, but you could claim, I'm not saying this would be completely genuine of someone to do this, but you could say, well, it wasn't until episode 7 that I really got on board with dynamic martial arts based lightsaber dueling. You could say that, but you'd still be a little disingenuous because really it's the prequels that informed that. That's just the way it is. Like, we have to at least accept, even if you hate the prequels, but you like this fighting thing, you have to at least make a little bit of a peace bridge right there and be okay with it.
And people who like this are admitting that they're fine with changes to the original source material to a certain extent. Like you said, maybe they're like, yeah, as a clip that I can enjoy, please don't change my original movie. That's fair.
Right.
But you know, the fact that this is wildly popular sort of entertains me a little bit. It tickles the trollish side of me a little. Like, oh, so you guys like changes to the original New Hope sometimes, and you like that style of fighting from the prequels.
Sure.
Like, you know, it's like some of the prejudice against the prequels is perfectly justified. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Some of it is just a little bit knee jerk sometimes.
Some of those people, though, too, would be angry if this was an official addition.
Yes.
to the final product. Like, if this was,
and they would be picky, like, oh, you can tell that that's not actually Alec Guinness there, how horrible. But because it's fan made, it's like, oh yeah, I'll forgive that, it's a cool battle, right?
Nerds are funny. Nerds are weird about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. we sure are. Let's talk about an ancient drug dealer.
Oh my gosh, finally.
Yeah, it's about time. A 1,000-year-old pouch was found in a rocky shelter in Bolivia containing traces of psychotropic plants, including cocaine.
Ooh.
Jose Capriles, assistant professor of anthropology at Penn State, said, "We did not know that these people were using so many different compounds and possibly combining them together. They're all in one pouch. And this is the largest number of psychoactive substances ever found in a single archaeological assemblage from South America. The pouch held two snuffing tablets, which were used to pulverize the plants into snuff so that you could sniff them.
Right.
A snuffing tube, which you used to snuff the snuff up your snuff. That was for smoking plants. The plants would have generated hallucinations. And then the pouch was constructed from three fox snouts."
Yeah. I mean, they had me right up at illicit drug use in the ancient times. You had me right up until you started using a fox snout to get it in there.
Fox snouts, man, make the best pouches. Traces of multiple plants came from different regions of South America.
Now, wow. Yeah.
I am with Justin from This Week in Science. They covered this on This Week in Science as well. This article and almost all the articles you're going to read about this talk about, like, this was obviously a shaman, and, you know, it was a very advanced shaman because it had multiple, you know, psychotropics from multiple relationships and or multiple regions. And so this implies that shamanism was at a higher ritualistic use, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Justin looked at this and I looked at this the same way. And I'm like, or this is a drug dealer, right? Like, you know what drug dealers do? They get drugs from lots of different places, and then they carry them in a pouch and sell them to people who want them.
Yeah, like, guess what they do? Also, they carry three fox snouts because they're going to sell more of them than just the one maybe they would use.
Yeah, they got so many drugs in there. They need three fox snouts to make their pouch.
Yeah, you don't
that's a big old pouch.
If you're really into pot, you don't have three bongs. You sell two of them to your friends who have money. Like, totally, this guy's a dealer, and I love it.
And Luke Sightwalker in our chat room points out, you know, another word for drug dealer is pharmacist. If you're approved by the government, so it could have been a pharmacist, like a traveling pharmacist who was like, "Yeah, I got what you need. to treat yourself. Now, these are psychotropics and hallucination drugs, so less likely that they were used purely for medicinal purposes, but you never know.
Well, and maybe they didn't know the difference. Like, you know, if somebody is down all the time and cocaine stimulates them, that's sure. medicine in a time where it's not demonized or outlawed yeah. or regulated or whatever. And so,
you know what he needs? A bout of hallucinations. I've got just the thing in my fox snout pouch.
I bet there's a good hit or two still left in that fox nose. Give it a shot. I assume the fox snouts were like, I don't know, petrified or
leather. Oh, yeah. No, there's actually a picture of the pouch in there. And you can look at, they're not petrified. They're treated. They're tanned. They're like any other leather type material, and they're sewn together.
Won't anyone think of those foxes, though?
Strike me just now. I can't believe I didn't think of this earlier, that a pouch full of things you put up your nose was made of noses. Well, like, maybe that's just branding.
I was going to say, maybe they felt really like, strong.
Oh, there. Yeah. I've got the things you put up your nose in my fox snout pouch. Uh-huh. And then I got the things I inject in your leg in my fox leg pouch.
We should get back to that.
Legs aren't very big on foxes.
We should get back to that in modern times. We should have...
All of my stomach things are made from fox belly pouches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You go to... let me think here. I'm going to... I can't think of anything good. I was going to say, I want to buy a sock. Or a pair of socks in 2019. Where do they come in? They come in a sock. Like just a big retail sock that you pull the socks out of. That'd be great. More of that.
I just want to hear the, you know, 1,000 years from now story about finding the backpack full of Quaaludes and uppers and Benzies. And this was obviously a shaman named Dougie Jones.
Dougie Jones the shaman. No relation to Doug Jones, the actor. And the
No, different guy.
Yeah, performance totally artist. Guy. We don't want to count him in there. But yeah, like, that's funny you bring that up. I like the concept, and I don't even think we see it that much in movies anymore, but I love the concept where in the story, we're so far flung in the future, and something so bad had happened to society that there's a giant blank of knowledge. Like, we just don't know what this skeletal remains and a backpack full of things that we've now tested know are drugs, but we don't have the context that this was some guy selling drugs on a street corner because we're just too far in the future. And so, like, what do phones look like then? What does a half-petrified video game controller mean to the future? And the truth is, we'll probably know just fine because we'll have some connective knowledge tissue between us and them. But I always like the idea that there's just a big space of we forgot everything. The bombs were so bad. Only five of us survived and everything was verbal. We don't know what a backpack even is in the year 8,000. Something I like about that.
The markings thought to form the word Eastpak must have been the name of one of their gods.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I'm trying to think. Do they do drugs today? Do you go?
Some garments inside emblazoned with the words North Face obviously were a command for their ritualistic demonstration.
I like it. There was an Under Armour logo. We're still studying it, trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I guess drugs are a thing. They've been here forever. Probably be here forever.
Going back, if y'all don't listen to This Week in Science, you ought to. People were the same back then as now. They just had different things and different levels of technology.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And acceptance. We'll say that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. University of South Carolina has received a donation of the entire comic book collection from a person in Ohio, estimated at more than 180,000 items, you know, mostly comic books, but apparently some other little items in there as well, worth around $2.5 million.
Jeez.
Some of the collection's comics will go on display at the Thomas Cooper Library on August 29th. So if you live near the University of South Carolina, you might want to head over there. It includes Avengers number one, the first appearances of Spider-Man, Batman, Black Panther, Iron Man, a bunch more. It was the life's work of an Ohio collector named Gary Watson, who started buying comics in 1958 and retired in 2010. And he told the South Carolina Post and Courier he is glad someone can take better care of them now. So he's not gone. He's just wanted to find a good home for them before he is gone.
And he's donating it. It is a donation. Yeah. I mean, well, he doesn't care, obviously, but I think I'd sell it. I'm like, is that bad? Should I feel more inclined to give this away to, you know, historical preservation, or is it okay to want to get my $2.5 million?
I don't know Gary Watson's health or state of mind.
Yeah.
But let's assume that Gary is seeing the end times for himself coming soon.
Yeah.
And he's like, maybe he just doesn't have a lot of family that he needs to help out, right? Mm. I'm creating a situation that I have no idea is true or not, but just hypothetically. No,
I like where you're going. This is good.
You're near the end of your life. All your friends and family are well taken care of. They're fine.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, if I get $2.5 million, what am I going to do with it?
Mm.
You know, I'm going. I can't take it with me. So instead of selling it, maybe I give it to an academic institution that can make good use of it and share it with more people.
Mm-hmm. No, and the truth is, 180. It used to be you could make money quicker on old comics, and those days are kind of gone. The values have dropped considerably across the board, and there are very few that are worth what they once were. So 180,000 comics. That's a lot of comics. Like, I don't know what he paid for every single one of those, but actually $2.5 million isn't that much for that many. That's a lot. Like, if you had an Action Comics number one and it was in perfect condition, you'd get $2.5 million for that single comic. It took him 180,000 of them.
An average of $13.88 per item.
I guess that's
so, hard. Yeah. I mean, your Avengers number one, that brings the average quite a bit up.
Yeah.
Your Archie number 75, but not worth that much.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, anyway.
Now watch that Archie number 75 accidentally be like the most amazing Archie or something by accident, because I don't know Archie comics, but I'm just guessing, right? Like one of those like mid-90s comics that got mass produced probably brings that average weight.
I wonder how many comics fit in a long box, like those ones you see.
How many long boxes? That's what I want to know. That's a great question.
Yeah, stacks. How many stacks of long boxes of 180,000 comics?
Because some of this are books, yeah. not just magazines, but the actual, like, you know, trades. There's a few of those in there. And they say, how did they put it? Books, magazines, and other items. So I'm guessing there might be some vinyl toys in here, things like that.
Sure. Related stuff, though. Like, I assume, like,
yeah,
it's not like there's some old painting in here also, but it's mostly, you know.
Oh, it's the painting that keeps him young, and he's finally done.
Oh, crap. All right. Well, now
he's
understand.
He's like, I am over this. I must give my painting away.
But actually,
here we go. Here's some more numbers I found. Okay. 143,000 unique comics, 20,000 magazines, 15,000 paperbacks, and 5,000 pulp publications.
Whoa.
And other items. It still has other items.
So little paperbacks, those are a little thicker. So I'm just trying to think of where he stored it. These are the logistics I always think about when I hear about this sort of thing. It's like
Star Trek number one is in this comic collection. The Brave and the Bold 28.
Whoa.
Which is the first appearance of the Justice League of America.
That's cool.
Fantastic Four one. Well, not number one, but first appearance of Fantastic Four, Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, Hulk, Spider-Man, Black Panther, Vixen, and Hal Jordan is the Green Lantern.
Does he have anything? It didn't say anything about like old Detective Comics, like number one or Action Comics one.
Mention of Superman, Batman. 26-foot-long moving trucks weighing in at 40,000 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Where did you keep all this? Were you on an episode? Was he on an episode of what's one? I can't even think of that show now. Hoarders or something, and we just didn't know they were comics. My gosh, that's a lot of comics. Holy,
that's a lot of comics.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of. I still want to know the number of long boxes, but that gives you an idea, right?
Man, he must have been just living in it, or he had storage somewhere, or who knows? But maybe this is
some comics from the Platinum Age, 1897, 1938. Mm-hmm. Some from the Golden, Silver, Bronze, and Modern Age.
Wow, 1800s comics from the 1800s.
Well, the Platinum Age runs from 1897 to 1938. I don't know. It doesn't say what his oldest comic from that era is. I
can't even imagine what that is.
I mean, Superman is Platinum Age. Is he not?
He's 32, 35, whatever it is.
The first Action Comics.
Yeah. So that stuff would fit in there. You're right. But if there were comics in the late 1800s, like what were they? Were they like cowboy adventures?
Penny Dreadfuls.
Oh, man. That kind of stuff, right?
I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
The actual Penny Dreadfuls that's the name.
Currentgeek@gmail.com. Send us your favorite comic from 1897. Let us know.
Yeah. Whatever, pull out your favorite. Give us a picture of
What's
you holding it.
What's your favorite first year Platinum Age comic?
Yeah. We want verification. Yeah,
I don't know anything about that. I'm sure it's famous to people who study it.
I'm completely out of my lane on this, but I love this stuff. So I'm going to just say hats off to Thomas Cooper. No, sorry, that's the library. Hats off to this guy. What's his name? Gary Watson, for his generous donation so that we, the people, can have a future with your comics. Nice job. Well done.
By the way, University of South Carolina has a picture of David Shea, who's a cataloger in the Irvin Department of Rare Books and Special Collections, who is like unpacking like the Green Lantern, Batman, all this stuff. He has got a grin 5 miles wide.
Is he wearing gloves?
He's not, but everything he's touching is in a bag.
Okay,
so.
Okay. Because you got to be careful.
That Green Lantern doesn't look like it's in a bag. That's just sitting out there.
Some of this
exposed to the air.
Some of this stuff is going to be, you know, you just got. I'm just saying, you got to do it with tender hooks. I know that. Oh, we learned last week. That's not what it means anymore. Tender hooks.
Tenter hooks.
Tenter hooks. Sorry, is not tender hooks after all, and it doesn't mean what we all thought tender hooks meant.
No, it means you're hanging your meat. No, wait. Do you want laundry? Laundry. Wool. It was wool.
It was your wool.
Yeah. Thought I'm out to dry.
Tender hooks is your meat, but it's not a phrase, so it doesn't matter.
Tenderloin
yeah.
on your tender hooks.
There you go. Oh, that sounds good.
Tenter hooks. Anyway, so yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I hope they can get it. I would love to just dig through that I would love to be somebody there outside of all the heavy lifting and organization work. I would love to be somebody who gets to sort of browse or come upon something and go, oh my gosh, look how old this one is, or look what good
shape
this is.
Well, and now that it's available, like you wouldn't have to be an employee. You could be a student at the University of South Carolina, have a research project on, you know, the history of comics and get access to this.
No.
Be able to look through it all. That's amazing.
Also, Ohio. Oh, I guess, yeah, you're right. It's not in Ohio.
He's from Ohio.
He's from Ohio.
I didn't see the connection between him and the University of South Carolina. Maybe that's where he went to college.
It keeps popping in my head because Ohio State, which I visited last year.
Ohio State.
Yes. I visited it last year, and they have this amazing comics museum. And they have the entire works of certain artists like Calvin Hobbes. Bill Watterson donated his entire original art.
Maybe Gary Watson hates his hometown, his home state university.
And it just could
wanted
be.
To be like, take, yeah, South Carolina's getting my collection.
But it was so cool, man. These guys have these in these vaults and it was all temperature controlled in there. I mean, I was nerding out just the way they'd handled this work, let alone how much of it they had. So they got themselves a little treasure trove. Hope it doesn't burn.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Ron Howard, I'll let you decide if you think this is cool. Ron Howard was talking to the MTV Happy, Sad, Confused podcast, and said that John Kasdan, Lawrence Kasdan's son, I believe, and a co-writer of Solo, A Star Wars Story, has been hounding Ron Howard about rebooting Willow as a series for Disney Plus. Howard said the title character would be a more mature Willow, older and wiser, and presumably faster with weaponry than he once was.
Yes. Do this, because I don't like Willow. And so I would like a more modern take on it.
That's not where I was expecting you to go with that sentence.
I figured you probably didn't, but I was never a fan of it. I don't know why. It just didn't work for me. Never liked it. And I wanted to. I wanted to like it. I like fantasy, and I'm into... You know, it's kind of a Hobbit movie, sort of, in its own weird way. It's like, here's a little short guy, and he's going to save the world. And even the tough ranger-type guy, played by Val Kilmer, he won't be the one. He'll have to humble up and then work with the little guy. And anyway, the story is okay, but I didn't like the movie very much, and so I just haven't given a lot of thought over the years. All that said, a modern take from Ron Howard... You still have what's his name could totally be Willow, a mature, older Willow. He's like our age.
Yeah.
What's his name? I forgot.
Anyway, Warwick
Davis, right?
Yep.
Warwick Davis is fantastic and would be great in this. Val Kilmer maybe he can't. I don't know. Like he's kind of beyond the prime there, so I don't know what you do here. But yes, I'm all for it, Tom. I believe in second chances.
I thought you were going to say yes because I loved Willow, not yes because I dislike Willow greatly.
I wish I liked it. I do. I know people love it. It's like their favorite thing. It's just their childhood. And
when I read this story out to Eileen, I was like, she's like, wait, which one's Willow? And then we'd be like, is that the David Bowie? Oh, no, that's not the David
Bowie.
Is that the one with Jim Henson? No, that's not the one.
Is that one? It's got the crystal. It's a dark crystal, isn't it?
No, wait, that's Dark Crystal.
Oh, that's Dark Crystal, right. Yeah, yeah, no, I. There are going to be people who are really mad at me right now. And I want to tell those people.
They could be mad at me, too, because I couldn't remember what Willow was at first.
Right, and I want them to know I don't want to take away from them what they got out of it. I wish I feel this way about Time Bandits, so I'm over the moon about the Taika Waititi Time Bandits TV show coming to Apple's service.
Taika Waititi.
Talk about Waititi.
Taika, not Taika, hard. Taika.
Taika.
Waititi. Really not hard.
I love him, though, and I would love his take on Time Bandits, so I'm all in on Time Bandits, like stoked about that.
Yes.
And I love Time Bandits, so I know there are people that are going, I love Willow, so I'm happy for you, A, and B, second chances, baby. Let's make it. Let's do it.
Yeah, right. I'm all for it. What struck me about this particularly, I mentioned this when we talked about it on Cord Killers, it really does seem Ron Howard's floating the idea to see what the response is, right?
Right.
Because you don't just go like, man, John, this writer friend of mine, John Kasdan, you know, from Solo, he just really wants me to pitch a Willow thing to Disney. What do you guys think? Mm-hmm. It's like, no. This is all a set piece, and he's floating it out there so Disney Plus can take a look, and the Disney folks can be like, okay, what's the social reaction? Was it positive? Was it negative? Would they like this? Let's see. So, yeah.
Yeah. Also, I'm thinking this John Kasdan might be a grandson of Lawrence Kasdan.
Grandson, is it?
And okay. Son of the other Kasdan.
Taika.
Taika Waititi.
I'm going to Why?
Waititi.
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 Yeah.
I have too much fun with it to change. I'm not going to change.
When you meet Taika,
yeah,
you can show him your dick of cards.
At your next band meeting? Is that when I can do it?
Band meeting?
Great.
Yes, that's fantastic. So, sure.
nice work. That was awesome.
Crankgeek@gmail.com. Let us know how to pronounce Taika. No, let us know what you think of Willow.
Yes.
You want a new Willow? I don't know.
I say go for it. It's not like your guys are doing anything else. Make it a TV show on Disney Plus, for heaven's sakes. Do whatever you got to do. That'd be fine.
Star Wars will not return to theaters.
Ever.
Until 2022.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Three untitled films. They haven't told us what the names of the films are. They never do. Will come out. They're going to stick with December. You know, they kept trying to be like, no, we really want to do it in May. Mm-hmm. December 16th, 2022. December 20th, 2024. December 18th, 2026. And that first one, the one in 2022, will be from Game of Thrones showrunners David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. If you didn't know, Rian Johnson is developing a trilogy. Benioff and Weiss are developing a trilogy. Bob Iger did not confirm that they're still trilogies. He didn't mention Rian Johnson. All he said was, and we're not saying anything more about that. But he did say, Benioff and Weiss, Star Wars movie, coming in 2022. Now, Iger did say he expected at least one more Star Wars television series on Disney Plus. We already know The Mandalorian is coming, and a spinoff prequel-ish Rogue One series is coming. But it sounds like we'll get another one. I'm curious what that might be.
I am also. And also, Benioff and Weiss are... do you remember the little thing they were doing? And now it's gone. It was going to be that, what if the Civil War ended differently and slavery continued? Do you remember that whole thing? And then...
Controversy. I think that's still in development, but they kind of had such a backlash that they quieted down on it. But Confederates, thank you, Sidian. I don't know that that's been actually killed.
Yeah, is that still going, or did they kill it? Because I know that was a big, messy...
I think they might have been well served by handing it over to someone else to run.
Yeah, probably.
They weren't the only ones on that.
Right. What I would have liked there is, well, whatever, this is a topic for a different show. Like, something about their concept I like. I just think the wrong people are making it. So maybe they're not making it anymore, and the right people are now. But the point is, Benioff and Weiss, they're going to have their hands all clean after next Sunday. We're good. They can move on to new projects. I'm sure they're well underway with whatever they're going to do for Star Wars. But 2022, Tom, oh my gosh, I guess they decided Star Wars every 6 months was not going to happen anymore.
No, they decided that a while back. Yeah. We heard a long time ago from Kathleen that I think it was her who said this, that that we are, that they're like, yep, that was wrong. We're reevaluating.
Right.
So this is the first word since she said that about what they've decided. And what they've decided is they're going to have 2019 be the Rise of Skywalker, and they're going to give it 3 years to cool off with the movies or with the shows on Disney Plus sort of filling the gap.
Yeah. Well, I can wait, I guess. I don't know. You and I aren't getting any younger. Let's hurry this up. I'd like to see what they do. Like a trilogy from those guys. Like I honestly, I just kind of want to see what those guys do outside of Game of Thrones. Like, can they, I mean, they're clearly talented men and their production team is great or whatever, but all we've seen is Game of Thrones, an incredibly well-made 8-season thing, despite what people may think of how it's ending. It's an amazing piece of work over a period of time. So I want to see what they do outside of the shroud of that. Like, what else do they have that's super, you know, they can bring to the table that will take Star Wars in new directions? So pretty jazzed about that.
Like X-Men Origins Wolverine?
Yeah. Yes.
I'm just looking at their writer credits for David Benioff.
I'm going to give that a big no, because that's a horrible
movie.
He
wrote the screenplay for X-Men Origins Wolverine.
You know what? I'll say this. That may not be his fault. It may have been a million other things that turned wrong for Origins. So I'm not going to hold that one up against him too much. But
also the Kite Runner and When the Nines Roll Over.
The Kite Runner is really good. That won a bunch of awards.
He wrote that.
Okay. Have they run other shows? They were never a showrunner for anything, though, right? Other than...
I'm looking. I don't think so. But then they won't be showrunners for the Star Wars movies. They'll be movie makers.
Movie runners.
they have directed... Benioff has directed 3 episodes of Game of Thrones.
Right. Wiki Kitten says half of Origins was great. Oh, no. No, 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 no. None of
Which
Origins.
Half?
Not, there is no such thing as a half that was good. Even if you took a bunch of pieces and then made it... you know, equal the amount of half, it still wasn't good. That's a bad
There's
bad
an
movie.
Unconfirmed report that David Benioff did ALF. Oh, wait, it's confirmed. He did not.
Oh, no.
I don't know where Kentucky Fried Computer got that.
Crap. I want that to be true.
Yeah, it would have been kind of funny, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would have been.
D.B. Weiss and David Benioff combined on an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And then Game of Thrones.
All right. That's an interesting place to start. But then you might say, oh, that's crazy. How do you go from that to that? But I would point people to the Russo brothers, who were most famous for episodes of Community.
Right.
Before they really blew up in movies with the MCU. Like, it's just day and night.
And D.B. Weiss was EP on The Specials.
The Specials. Those of those superhero
TV series
types.
Documentary. I don't know.
Oh, documentary. I have no idea what that is. Yeah. All right. Well, nonetheless, And hopefully with all this experience under their belt, they'll be able to take Star Wars by the horns and really put it in its place.
Yeah.
We'll have to wait until 2022 to find out, but you do not have to wait to find great content here on this show, because some of our subredditors are amazing. And Tom, we should probably give some of them credit. Who gave us stuff this week?
Arup Mav Mike, Jeff Rose, Luke Garou, and Wayne Something all submitted stories on the subreddit at currentgeek.reddit.com that we use today. Get on over there to currentgeek.reddit.com and just vote till you drop, folks.
Oh my gosh. It
helps us make a better show.
I like the vote till you drop idea, except for the dropping part. Seems like
Well, vote until you're ready to do something else.
Okay. I can see that. How about this? Rolling, 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 rolling. That's right. It's time for our segment called Keep On Roland, where Tom reads Scott a passage from French literary critic Roland, I never say his last name right, Barthes?
Barth.
Barthes. There's no S.
Yeah, with the possessive, you'd say, from French literary critic Roland Barthes' seminal work.
Oh, I get it. There's the apostrophe for a reason, Scott. From his seminal work, Mythologies. Tom?
Mythologies.
Take it away.
This is the beginning of the section called Photography and Electoral Appeal.
All right.
Some candidates for parliament, remember we're talking about France here, some candidates for parliament adorn their electoral prospectus with a portrait. This presupposes that photography has a power to convert which must be analyzed. To start with, the effigy of a candidate, that means the photo, establishes a personal link between him and the voters. The candidate does not only offer a program for judgment, he suggests a physical climate, a set of daily choices expressed in a morphology, a way of dressing, a posture. Photography thus tends to restore the paternalistic nature of elections, whose elitist essence had been disrupted by proportional representation and the rule of parties. Inasmuch as photography is an ellipse of language and a condensation of an ineffable social whole, it constitutes an anti-intellectual weapon and tends to spirit away politics, that is to say, a body of problems and solutions, to the advantage of a manner of being, a socio-moral status. It is well known that this antithesis is one of the major myths of Pujadism. Pujad on television saying, "Look at me, I am like you."
Wow. I feel like there's a lesson in there. Don't know what it is.
Essentially what he's saying is adding photos to political stuff means people make their decisions for the wrong reasons.
Oh, okay.
Because they get swayed by the photo as an ellipse of language, making them make socio-moral decisions instead of rational ones.
I think I agree with him. I mean, I'm not saying
no more photographs.
I don't think it's ruined
politics.
It hasn't ruined the world, and we'll keep doing it, but he's not entirely wrong.
I mean, he doesn't even get to video, right?
No. He doesn't.
Talking during the land of television, though. Let me see. This is first written in 1957.
Yeah. He was a man of our time. Well, a man of his time and sort of a man of our time now, if you want to look at it that way. But
Roland Barthes says, no more photos, please.
Well done. No more photos, please. But please, please, please be a patron of Current Geek. Oh, yes. Go to patreon.com/currentgeek and support the show, because that is how we make the show. We make it with your generous giving, and that giving comes with it. We give stuff back in return, including a great show each and every week, and our love, and some extras, which you can only get at patreon.com/currentgeek. So please, give us more, hang out with us more, be with us more, and that's all the more as I have to say. Now, there's this.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right. Back in the day, we had a show, and it was called Forecast. And every week, it was about predicting the future. It got canceled. But we knew there was a piece of that that should exist and stay alive. And that piece is here today. It's called Forecast. It's a segment now where we predict the future based on all sorts of factors. Tom, you had it this week. Tell us, what does our future hold?
So I've been hearing a lot of stories about superbugs, mm-hmm. about how we can encourage pharmaceutical research to develop alternatives to antibiotics, as antibiotics slowly are becoming less effective because of the overuse of them in a lot of cases, which creates bacteria that are resistant. And, you know, the short version, if people don't understand that, is let's say you got 100 bacterium,
yep.
and you kill 99 of them and one lives, that one living might not cause much of a problem. Okay. But if you have 100 bacterium and you kill 80 of them and 20 live, well, then that 20 are not going to be killed by that antibiotic anymore.
Hmm.
And we're getting to a point where it used to be maybe one lived, but then that one went off and had some more. And then now it's, maybe 20 of them are living, 30 of them are living. And so we use the antibiotics too much. It encourages the bacteria to develop resistance, mm-hmm. Because we keep killing the ones that we can kill, leaving only the ones that survive. Anyway, this is a big problem. And people are worried about it because it's not really making a lot of money to develop new antibiotics. However, I have also been hearing a lot of stories about getting really close to finding evidence of life on Mars. And we're going to be exploring more asteroids. We're going to be eventually, I think someday, exploring Io and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. I think these streams are going to cross. And at some point, we will discover life on one of these extraterrestrial bodies that will help us to create medicine to combat superbugs.
Wow. All right, let me throw this in there, because this seems like a complication. One of the problems in human history was if a bunch of people moved from one region to another, they brought with them their bacterial and viral stuff that they were now immune to because they'd already dealt with it, but they brought it to a people who hadn't had it before, so now they're all sick. or die or whatever. Or die or whatever. It's kind of gnarly. Anyway, so that was the thing that would happen then. If we got out to the got out to Mars and we discover some life form there, let's say it's just some little lizard thing, like Star-Lord kicked in his movie Guardians of the Galaxy. I won't say where else he does it. Anyway, and they are going to provide these new antibodies to work with. Wouldn't we put them at risk, or wouldn't they put us at risk at first, though, with the introduction of this new strain?
So you're talking about two different things. You're saying, I predict that instead they'll infect us, right? I'm not saying the life we find causes us to develop antibodies.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah.
We're not talking about developing antibodies. We're talking about killing bacteria.
Okay.
Right? Antibiotics kill the bacteria in you so that it no longer can proliferate and cause an immune response and cause you to be sick.
Right.
And damage you. So what I'm saying is we'll find life, and that life will introduce genetic complexity that that bacteria will not be able to develop resistance to because it's too alien.
Mm. Okay. I get
it. So it's not, usually what people say is, oh, if we find life on other planets, what if it, you know, is incompatible with us and kills us, you know, and it's a problem. And that's perfectly that's a possibility, right? That's a legitimate concern. But I'm saying, what if instead we're able to use that material basically from the life on other planets to kill bacteria here in a way that doesn't cause resistance to be built, and boom, goodbye superbugs.
Or at the very least, reset the resistance to a new level, like, you know, heighten its inability to fight. I get that.
It depends on how you kill them, right? If you kill them by disrupting the lipids or causing mitosis to fail, a lot of that you can be like, oh, well, we'll just create new lipids or we'll change the binding site that used to cause us to fail.
Yeah.
If you kill them by, this is like alcohol, isopropyl alcohol works really well. You don't get a lot of resistance built up to isopropyl alcohol because it just kills by making it impossible to live.
Right.
And it's a small enough amount on us that it doesn't damage us, but man, bacteria don't like it.
Right.
Isopropyl alcohol, not something you can take internally, or you really shouldn't if you want to keep your sight in your life.
Yeah.
So this is like, oh, maybe this will come up with something that can act like isopropyl alcohol in our bloodstream in a way that doesn't damage us.
Yeah, I like this. I think this is a good idea. I think the science fiction head on all of us wants to come up with the kryptonite, and that's the wrong direction, or it's the opposite of what you're saying. So I shouldn't
it's not
think
necessarily wrong.
Yeah, but, yeah, I shouldn't think about War of the Worlds aliens coming here to kill us and then finding out water destroys them. Or what was the deal?
Yeah.
It wasn't water. It was they weren't immune to our whatever.
I think in the movie version, the original movie version, they got a cold.
That's what it was, right? They had no protection against it, and it quickly ripped their assault apart. That's how I want to go, but I like your direction. I like where you're going. I think yours is also more realistic. The other stuff is just based on human fear about people being invaded. So,
and human fear is a real thing.
It is. It exists. It permeates our society sometimes.
It connects us and binds us.
It does.
Wait. Like the Force?
Makes us stronger than we were before. Wait, what?
That's what the Sith believe.
Sorry. Shoot. Yeah. Gosh dang it. Freaking Sith always poking their butts in here where they're not a welcome. Time for this. It's the best thing of all time this week. That's right. The best thing of all time this week. Things that Tom and I are into this week that we just think are the best thing of all time this week. And mine is the HBO miniseries Chernobyl, which is only 2 episodes in. Speaking of preying on human fear, that thing is gnarly and apparently highly accurate, which is, I think, one of the things I appreciate about it the most. But I think the thing I appreciate the most is they took this real life tragedy and accident and put a human face on it all. Because from where we were in 1986, I was just a teenager in school. This seemed like a trillion miles away and had no impact on us and just seemed like a dumb thing the Russians did.
Oh, it happened to the commies, right?
Right.
So there was a bit of that attitude.
There was definitely that attitude. I remember people kind of having this flippant attitude of like, yeah, that's what communism gets you.
That'll teach you.
Yeah. And I remember thinking not a whole lot about it. As I've matured and gotten older, I realized that it's a thing I just don't know a lot about. And this show is extremely good. It's really good. I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, it's depressing. It's hard to watch in some ways. It's not particularly graphic, although it's very, I think, accurately portrayed graphically. But it's not. They're not going for blood and gore. They're not going for the ravages of radiation in a way that's sensationalizing it. And it just feels like an accounting of what happened. One thing I do appreciate also is they're not aiming to make everybody have Russian accents, nor is the whole thing in Russian with nothing but Russian subtitles or English subtitles. Mm. Instead, they're having every actor in every case, including the guy that plays Gorbachev, everybody plays whatever they are. So if you're a British actor, you've got a British accent. If you're a Swedish actor,
really.
You have a Swedish accent. They don't have any Russian accents except people that happen to be Russian actors or people from that region. Not necessarily Russia, but you know, other parts around there. And it works. It really works. And it gets out of the way. Like it moves the connections I have with, oh, Russia, the Red Scare, all that. It pushes that to the side and just says, horrendous thing that happened. Incredibly heroic response by some, a chicken response by others, a government response by a government that was trying to protect its image, and then a world that could see it anyway. Like, it's just a naked portrayal of what Chernobyl was, and we're only two episodes in. I don't know how long this goes. It's like six episodes or something. Completely into it. Love it. I think, Tom, I think you'd love it if you watch it, and you should. Wait until it's done. Just catch up, whatever. I really like Chernobyl a lot, and I think that thing's going to be smeared all over Oscar season. Guaranteed.
You know, you have. I was sort of like, well, that looks interesting, but I don't know if I have time.
Yeah.
You may have swayed me to be like, you know what? Let me give this a shot, because I was worried that it would be a little sensationalistic or overdramatic, but it sounds like they just treat it head on.
They do. They treat it very, very head on. And also, I think you'll like the actors in this. This one guy who seems like he's in everything, but they're all such different roles. And I don't know his name, and I wish I had it in front of me, and I could probably look it up. But he was in The Expanse. In the first season, he played the terrorist leader, or the belter leader.
Oh, yeah.
Super interesting guy. And then he went on to be on The Crown. Was he on The Crown?
He's been in a bunch of stuff. I think he was in The Crown, maybe.
Yes, he was The Crown. He was the King, King Stutter, the Stutter King.
Yeah, King George.
King Stutter. Anyway, the Stuttering King. And he was great in that. And he's in good in everything. And in this one, he plays this, he works at a Moscow-based, he's a professor at the university there, the Institute for something. And he is so, so perfect for the role. And then you got this other guy, that Swedish actor, whose name I don't know, but who was also in the first Avengers movie. He's in a million things, billions of things. He's on some popular Swedish TV show that's on Netflix
now. Guy from Thor?
Yes, that guy.
Skarsgård.
Yes. Thank you. That guy. Yes. Is it Skarsgård? Yeah, it is. That is him.
Stellan Skarsgård. Thank you, Wabbit Magic.
He plays a higher up in the Politburo kind of military dude who's on direct orders from Gorbachev to sort of act in his stead while he's in Chernobyl and making calls there and stuff. And he's really fantastic. Like, across the board, amazing actors, people you know, some you don't, and you should watch it. And everything has this horrible yellow hue to it, which is very, you know, just Soviet imagery in general has a thing going on. It's hard to describe, but there's just something about Soviet imagery. And they've got that down without it feeling like a cartoon or a caricature. And then the actual event literally put off this sort of yellow hue to everything. And they just captured that so well. It's harrowing stuff. Not for the faint of heart. If that sort of stuff freaks you out, don't watch it. But I think it's really good. All right, Tom, what'd you do this week that you love so much?
Well, after you have been turned into a quivering pile of sadness from watching Chernobyl, you'll need something to lift your spirits. So I also highly recommend a television show this week, What We Do in the Shadows, from Jemaine Clement.
And showrunner Taika Waititi.
Taika Waititi. T-T. Jermaine Clement is the showrunner on it. He's involved in every show. Taika is an executive producer, but I don't think he has as much day-to-day involvement. Yeah. But it definitely has the same sensibility as the original movie. So I was a little worried, like, nah, I don't know if a TV show can recapture it. Absolutely does. Even though it's set in the U.S., it's set on Staten Island, and it's three ancient vampires, four actually, living in a house together. One of them is an energy vampire, and that is the genius move, because you have the three vampires of, you know, they're both, like, they're all vaguely Eastern European. One of them's English. In fact, the English one, the English guy, is the guy who plays the CEO in the It Crowd, if you remember that show.
Oh, right. The one that, the son that took over after the dad jumped out the
window.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. He's great. Yeah. And then there's an energy vampire who's just kind of a regular guy. He goes to work at an office and he just bores people and sucks the energy out of them. And it's hilarious.
I love that idea. I mean, there are two,
and even the blood sucking vampires who live with him don't want him around because he sucks the energy.
He sucks their energy. Well, like, there were two great movies in 2015, Mad Max: Fury Road and this. They were the two best movies of that year. What We Do in the Shadows blew my mind. I never wanted it to go away, and I couldn't wait till they did more. And this is apparently what we were all waiting for. From all accounts I've heard, like, the show lives up to the standard and carries it forward in some really great ways. I'm so happy to hear you like it, because I want to watch it.
Every episode's fun. Every episode's good.
Yeah.
The most recent episode is filled with guest appearances. Not just the guest appearances you might suspect from seeing the movie.
Yeah.
I'm talking about unexpected, amazing, hilarious guest experiences.
I heard there might be another. You can just confirm this. I'll be vague about it. But apparently somebody who is also in the MCU makes an appearance in this episode. Is that true? Maybe more than one. I don't know. All right, I'm gonna finally start the damn thing, because it's just been nothing but praise from all the people I trust, and you have to either buy it
Like at Vudu or iTunes or something, or get it through your FX app. If you're a subscriber to, like, PlayStation View or Sling TV or regular cable, it's on FX.
Yep. So there you go. Chernobyl, HBO. And then this one, What We Do in the Shadows, available now. And probably four or five episodes in, something like that.
Seven.
Oh, wow. And already approved for season two. So that's cool.
Yep. Season two. And yeah, I think just maybe just
FX. Two and three. FX is one of my favorite networks. They do stuff that I love. So Fargo and this. And, like, I always like what they do. So do check that out. All right.
Disney's FX, by the way.
Oh, my gosh, dude. I hadn't thought of that.
Yep.
Could they just roll all that into Disney Plus if they wanted? Maybe.
Nope. They're going to roll it into Hulu.
Oh, right. I keep forgetting how much they own of that.
They own all of it. Well, they made a deal today with Comcast to have controlling interest, because the previous deal didn't allow, even if you were a majority shareholder, you still had to consult the minority ones.
Yeah.
So they changed the deal now that Disney runs Hulu entirely, and within 5 years, probably will sell. Comcast will sell the little bit that they own.
I got in this thought loop the other day that Disney is becoming that giant corporation that owns everything, but we're all okay with it. Well, they're not. It's not true.
That's Alphabet.
You're right. But my point is, like, in the entertainment world, they're becoming a pretty heavy force, and it's easy.
Do they own Netflix?
No. But it's pretty easy.
Amazon?
It's pretty easy. Hold on. When I get to this point, you realize that I'm actually not swinging that way. Because my thing is, they wouldn't be here doing expansive things if they weren't also kicking butt in the areas that they were winning in. Like, in other words, they're killing it with Marvel. They're doing great with Star Wars. Like, they're actually kind of, I mean, they continue to do great with all their animation departments, including the Pixar acquisition, like, all of that stuff. They're good at it. So it's hard to deny them the success. And so I don't even want to feel like it's, you know, encroaching on, you know, I don't know, corporate overlordness, because they're making really good things right now. They'd have to really blow it. And if they did, they would recede a little bit, you know?
I had a long discussion about whether this is just a sort of perception issue, because Disney has bought a lot of high profile things,
yeah.
right? And successful things. Yeah. And they've been a good steward of the things that they've had for a while. Because when I look at it, like Disney, not bigger than Comcast.
Whoa.
Comcast owns a lot more things than Disney. Disney owns a lot of intellectual property. Comcast owns intellectual property and the pipes that the property is delivered on. That concerns me more than owning a bunch of really good intellectual property.
There you go. The whole bottom line is Comcast, you are too powerful.
And you know who's bigger than Verizon, Comcast, and Disney?
Who?
Who's bigger than Comcast and Disney is Verizon.
Oh, my Lord, really?
And AT&T Time Warner is also bigger. And Alphabet and Amazon, also bigger.
And maybe Apple, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, well, Apple's bigger. It starts to be apples and oranges.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I know which one the orange is. Anyway, all right, quick phone call. No, phone call, just kidding. Email. People are afraid to call us, so they don't ever use this number, 801-471-0462. You can call anytime you want, but we just don't get a lot of current geek calls. It's fine. We got this one from Chuck Byers, who sent an email who said this: I can hardly wait to hear your takes on 12 Angry Men, which is in, let's see, 3 weeks, or 2 weeks. 2 weeks, we'll have that.
No, three.
Three?
Yeah, next week is Autopilot, then yeah. A headline.
I guess I'm counting today, or no, I'm not counting today. Well, anyway. It's okay, soon. It'll be sandwiched. Yes, you're absolutely right. It's about 3 weeks. Anyway, it's one of my favorites. He says when he was in seventh grade in 1976, the senior high drama play was 12 Angry Jurors. They had girls playing some of the parts. Anyway, they did a good job and got me hooked. I found the original with Henry Fonda and Jack Klugman et al. On late night TV shortly after, and was blown away by those performances. You probably know this, but it was remade for TV in 1997. I didn't know this, by the way. Had no idea.
Me either.
With Jack Lemmon in Fonda's part, Tony Danza was in it too. Buried the lead there, buddy. Anyway, that's great as well. I hope you find it as awesome as I did. I'll be listening, Chuck. He says, from New Hampshire, originally from Pennsylvania, so I am a vampire hobbit. Ooh.
Ah, blah, blah, blah.
Blah. So, yeah.
Cool. I'm glad people are enjoying the film festival. I think it's starting to pay off.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like I have a better appreciation for movies in general, including my own geeky movie favorites by geeking out over these great films.
Oh,
this has been really fun.
Absolutely how I feel about it. And I went into it thinking, well, this will be like Film Sack. It's a thing I watch and then I'll kind of forget about or whatever. But unlike Film Sack, we're focusing almost entirely, well, we are focusing entirely on good films, like objectively, if not objectively, at least, you know, respectively great movies. And it has broadened my horizons. It's made me think different about movies and acting and also when these things were made and what it meant to make a movie in the 40s versus now. And like it's been a way bigger deal for me than I expected it to be. And it seems like the listeners are on board, and that makes me very happy. So very nice.
Now, for television fans, we have Autopilot episodes, and next week will be an Autopilot episode of The Greatest American Hero.
Look what happened to me, right? That's the song?
Mr. Hinckley. Can't call him that anymore. He's Mr. H.
Wait, I got to find this. Greatest American. I just have to hear a little bit. Just a tiny bit of the theme.
Yeah, it's a classic, man.
Yeah, it's
hard to... I already actually played the beginning of the episode just to hear it, to be honest.
All right, let's see. Apple Music is being dumb. Okay, here it is. So I'm just going to play a tiny taste. There you go. Starts us off. Oh, yeah, dude.
I love Mike Post.
Isn't that great? Freaking Mike Post. Oh, that guy. Anyway, that's what we're going to watch, and I'm excited about it because it's been forever, probably since high school, since I saw an episode, and I don't remember the pilot at all, so we're going to see the origin story of The Greatest American Hero, and wasn't Robert Stack, in, not Robert Stack, the guy from I Spy was in it.
Tony Danza.
No. It's the, the guy that wasn't Bill Cosby, and I don't remember his name, so that's
Mo Green.
Oh, sure. Yes, Mo Green, coming soon to a small screen near you. That's the Autopilot edition of Current Geek covering Greatest American Hero, and that's next week. Don't forget, if you hang around here to the end of the show, you'll get to hear Legal Geek this week. He'll be reviewing a recent trademark infringement lawsuit filed between two tabletop giants. They make games for the tabletop, you know, board games, over the wildly popular Great Western Trail game. That sounds super interesting, so you're going to want to check that out. That's right after we're done talking here for you folks at home, so stick around. I think that's going to do it. Tom, before we go, do you have anything you'd like to promote or mention?
Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun chatting with people who subscribe to the Free Tom newsletter at freetomnews.com. Because you can just respond to it. In fact, if you respond to the newsletter, it actually helps the newsletter be delivered to more people. So it doesn't end up in spam folders because Gmail will say, oh, this is an email people actually respond to. I guess it's not spam. So become a newsletter subscriber at freetomnewsletter.com. You'll get a weekly missive from me about what my week's been like, as well as links to all the things I've done that week, updates on my writing, some GIFs. You can respond to it and I'll respond back. It's all at freetomnewsletter.com.
Nice. For me, everything else you need is over at frogpants.com. Plenty of shows to check out. Check out the morning show. Tom shows up on those on Wednesdays as well. So if you're not getting enough Ace Detect today, you'll get enough then. We got a lot of other stuff going on, so check it out. Frogpants.com, currentgeek.com for our website, patreon.com/currentgeek if you want to support us. And as always, send your emails to currentgeek@gmail.com. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review a lawsuit filed that could pit two of the top tabletop game companies against one another over the wildly popular Great Western Trail board game. A few weeks ago, Stronghold Games, which is now owned by Indie Game Studios, sued Plan B Games in Indiana federal court for a number of claims. Stronghold is known for games like the Terraforming Mars series. Plan B Games is a quick riser in the tabletop field, releasing recent top hits like the Century Spice Road series of games, as well as Coimbra and Reef last year. The game in controversy is Great Western Trail, which is currently ranked in the top 10 of the industry site BoardGameGeek's top game rankings. According to the complaint filed by Stronghold, they contracted with the German publisher, Eggertspiele, to be the exclusive distributor of this game in the US and Canada in 2016, for a period of time that was to extend through the end of 2018. The first print run sold out very quickly, and Stronghold sought more copies from Eggertspiele to sell. Those copies were never provided, as in the middle of 2017, Eggertspiele was acquired by Plan B Games. Plan B Games then brought out their own print run of Great Western Trail in early 2018, and the game has continued to sell very well. Stronghold is filing this lawsuit because it is allegedly missing out on the opportunity to sell this highly popular game, thanks to the actions of Eggertspiele and then Plan B. What's interesting about this case is the type of claims made by Stronghold. Instead of breach of contract, as you might expect, Stronghold is claiming trademark infringement and unfair competition by Plan B Games, as well as conspiracy with Eggertspiele to deny Stronghold the benefit of the deal. The conspiracy claim is a bit far-fetched and thrown in at the end, so for today's segment, let's focus more on the trademark-type claims. The complaint sets out in great detail how Stronghold marketed the Great Western Trail game in advance of that initial print run being sold. Stronghold is making the case that these marketing efforts and their sales in the marketplace generated common law trademark rights automatically that then were infringed when Plan B Games brought out the same game without permission from the alleged trademark holder. There is case law in the US on cases involving exclusive distributors and generation of trademark rights. If it's not covered by the contract between the game manufacturer and the distributor, then it's not automatic that selling the game results in a trademark right for the exclusive distributor. Instead, courts apply a rebuttable presumption that the manufacturer retains any trademark rights, with a multi-factor test to determine if the presumption can be rebutted in favor of the exclusive distributor. These factors can include things like which party created the mark, which party first affixed the mark to the goods, which party paid for promotion of the goods, and which party's name appeared on packaging, among other things. In this case, it's not a slam dunk that Stronghold actually created any trademark rights here. The fact that this is not a breach of contract claim is interesting, because it likely means the contract does not read how Stronghold would want it to. So Stronghold is making a claim that thinks outside the box, and looks like it has merit on its face, even though the legal standards in the US will make this an uphill battle in all likelihood for Stronghold. The bottom line is, when making deals to sell products from a manufacturer, you have to be absolutely sure the contract is done right. Otherwise, in a worst-case scenario like this one, where the product is wildly popular and the manufacturer gets bought out by another company, you may have to stretch your legal theories to try and exact revenge for losing the benefit of a deal. I expect this case will likely settle out of court, but we will keep an eye on it because the claims made are so unique to this situation, and it could have long-lasting effects on these two big players in our beloved board game field. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.